Hello and welcome back to season 3 of Listening to the Dead.
Hello and welcome to season 3, episode 5. We're delighted to all be back together to record this one in person and to welcome back fibres expert Dr. Anne Priston, who's joining Linda, Kaz and myself today to discuss Operation Airlines, the provisional IRA plot to blow up 6 electrical substations around London with 37 devices and disrupt the capital's power supply for months. And it's quite fitting that we're gathered here today at Linda's house because it's around this area that the terrorists rented their bases of operation, a garage in Wimbledon and flats in Tooting and Wandsworth. So, to set the scene a little bit, it was 1996, 3 years after a ceasefire was declared with the IRA. The 7 men who came over to carry out the plot were the most senior IRA operatives ever to be brought together for an operation on the mainland. However, the UK police got wind of the plot and launched Operation Airlines, a covert investigation to foil the campaign and gather evidence to prosecute those planning it. After weeks of surveillance, they swooped, arresting the 7-man team and seizing bagfuls of evidence, much of which was delivered to Anne Priston and her team to analyse. So this is where we turn to you, Anne. What are your memories of being called into this case and how did it come to land on your desk?
Well, at that time, I was the sole person responsible for fibre analysis for work coming in from the anti-terrorist branch. So it would naturally have come to me. And it would have also been allocated to other scientists within the laboratory as well. But I don't remember actually what happened. But what is likely to have happened is that we would have received a phone call from Scotland Yard to say that this work was coming in. Now, they wouldn't just have dumped it on us. We would have had telephone call and discussions and meetings. And it didn't come to me in one single lot. It would have gone partly to the explosives laboratory in Fort Halstead. In fact, the bombs themselves would have gone there first. And we would have had, in fact, we did have other items to start working on. So it had to be planned, a sort of strategy formed and started working on parts of the exhibits to start with.
I see. So did you know about it while surveillance was going on?
No.
You weren't prepared?
No, we didn't. And I don't think that the officers that were involved knew quite what the scale of it. They knew it was a very extensive and lengthy business, the surveillance. I don't know whether they suspected the bombs to be as they were when they were discovered. So, no, I didn't know what was coming in until the police had it and then phoned up and said, this is major, we need to have a chat.
Well, we'll get on to the bombs in a moment. I'm just going to bring you in, Kaz, here, because this is a massive operation for the police. You know, 10 days of surveillance, there'd have been, you know, there's been serious worries about how prepared it was and how far along it was. What sort of resources does it soak up within the Met?
Oh, blimey. An awful lot, that's for sure. I mean, you're going to have surveillance 24/7 every day of the week. You're going to have other officers working 24/7 inside, doing other inquiries about people, I would imagine. It takes up an awful lot of resources, and you have to get it right because you need the evidence there. But I would imagine that originally, probably, it was information that came in from Ireland itself through an informant, and they probably then began to work on that. But you know, it can be just one little bit of information. Whether it's true or not, you don't know. But you have to follow it up, and then if things start to grow, and as the original information grows, more evidence comes in, then the whole thing gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Can I just add at that point, in fact, this operation involved the security services and special branch and the anti-terrorist branch. So it was absolutely huge and very costly and really all power to them for, you know, financing it as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got with you a sort of a dummy casing of a bomb that was found at the scene. And I'm going to pass it. Thank you very much for bringing this, Anne. This is amazing. I'm going to pass it to Linda to describe what it is we've got here and what the bombs look like.
All right. If you imagine a very large shoebox, and this has been very carefully constructed, it has two small hinges. It's made from, I would say, very cheap wood. And it's extraordinary to think that these boxes were handmade, but then added to that, they had three different partitions inside them, which Anne will describe later. But holding the box, it is really unnerving to think how many of these boxes were constructed, but not only carefully constructed, the screws, the hinges, the preparation that had gone in, but they were tightly wrapped with very wide tape, sticky tape, not sellotape, thicker tape than that, which Anne will also explain how fascinating it was to them to find it and remove it.
Yeah. Oh, I've just clipped the lid shut there. So it's gaffer tape that just goes, or roofing tape almost, that goes round and round it to hold it all together, I think, Anne. And that's going to be quite crucial with your role in this. I mean, you've also bought, I should say, documents, reams of documents, which is just amazing, and some pictures from the scene. And they show that, as Linda explained, inside you had a timer, a battery, and then the explosives themselves. And that when the police swooped, 37 devices were wired up being charged at the time.
That's right. These bombs, well, time and power units, they were called, they were found in the basement of one of the house that the IRA members had rented. The box was divided so that one compartment would contain the explosive, which was thought to have been 2.5 kilos of Semtex per box. One would have contained the battery and one would have contained the timer. And the batteries were all charged, ready to go. They were connected to the mains and wired up, ready to go when the police actually swooped onto the property in the early hours of the morning.
So that sort of raises the question, Kaz, 10 days of surveillance, when did they decide when to go in? It sounds like they were pretty close to mistiming this, or were they absolutely perfect?
I would imagine, I mean, I've not actually worked on the anti-terrorist squad as such, other than some attachment to it briefly, but I would imagine it would be the senior officer in charge. He has to make that decision. And it would probably come to a point where they think, are they going to arm these? Are they ready to go? At what state are they? And he has to make that call. And I think it's when it would become when they feel that life is at danger. And even while they're making those devices in the flats or whatever, there's also the risk that other people in the next door flat, the next door buildings could be blown up, because it has been known for the devices while terrorists are actually making the devices that they've gone off. So I think all those sort of things would come into play, and they thought, right, if the evidence is in there, we've got them now, let's go in and take them out before they can actually get out there and plant the bombs.
I think when the bombs, the boxes were discovered, there was no explosive, and I think the authorities were anticipating that the delivery of the Semtex was imminent. And I think it was that that triggered, as Kat says, the senior officers. It would have been, as I say, Special Branch and the security services and the police officers to make that. I mean, the whole command would have been involved in making that final decision to go in.
Yeah. I think you found out something about the explosives and where they came from normally.
From what I've read, it appears that a lot of them, Semtex itself in the 80s, there was large amounts brought in from Libya and taken into a port in Ireland, and then it was hidden. And that, I think, was about 86 it came in, but they believe that Semtex was still being used many years later.
And that cache of Semtex was sitting there just gradually being used. Well, I mean, I said that there had been this ceasefire since 94, but actually there had been the bomb in the Docklands in 96, so sort of the provisional IRA had taken over the sort of the bombing campaign on the mainland. And so there had been one or two. So, okay, we know that this was found. Your pictures show, Anne, how they were found. So what was delivered to you? Did you get all the devices once they were made safe, delivered to you, or how were they delivered to you in your lab?
No, we started working because, you see, it wasn't just the devices. When the police did this coordinated swoop, there were some flats that had been rented, garages, motor cars, and the house, and the bombs were found in the house. So the seven defendants, suspects as they were then, were arrested in that property, together with all the clothing. The clothing was distributed all over the place. I mean, the men were naked. It was a dawn raid, so they didn't have any clothes on. They didn't have rooms and wardrobes and nice beds and stuff like that. There were just clothes in bin bags, the whole lot. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of items of clothing were seized. In the garage and in the cars, they found some aluminium ladders which had been sawn into threes in lengths that would fit widthways into the cars that they'd hired. And the idea was that when they got to the destination, the ladders would be reassembled so that they could scale the walls. They also found maps, shopping lists, timers, the 100-hour timers from washing machines and so on. And it was obvious that the target was going to be the National Grid power substations in the south of the country. So that was the target. So the thing that came to us, first of all, were the tapes from the ladders, from around the ladders. The ladders were bound together with tape. The bombs themselves would have gone to Fort Halstead for the explosives laboratory. And we didn't get those to start with, and we didn't get the clothing to start with. We started working on the tape, and it sounds an odd thing to do, to say, well, we'll look at the tapes before we get the clothing, because in fibre work, normally, you have tapes from a car or a weapon or other clothing, but you have a target. You're looking for contact with something else. In cases like this, that's not the situation. You have to remove everything, partly because you don't know what they're wearing, so you can't target any one item and just pick off whatever that is. And also because the method of retrieval in cases like this is different. In normal cases, you retrieve the extraneous fibres yourself with clear sellotape, which you can examine through the back of the sellotape to look for your target fibre. This tape was grey, 2-inch wide elephant tape, what we call elephant tape. So you can't look through the back of it. It's very, very adhesive. It's threaded through with linen to make it really strong. And of course, it's opaque. So it has to be removed. And you can't remove it straight away because the fingerprint department will be wanting to look on the inner surface for fingerprints. So I'm digressing, but it's a different technique. So we started just looking at the tape from around the ladders, removing all of the fibers that we could see to start with.
Wow. So you've got seven men and all of their clothing coming eventually once you get it. Why the delay, by the way? What was?
Well, it's a good idea not to have that much clothing submitted straight away because of contamination. I mean, it's all got to be housed, it's got to be stored, it's got to be looked after and packaged. So we just got the tapes in to start with. And given that our approach was to remove everything, we didn't need to know what the clothing was. We didn't need to know what the target was. We just had to get it all off. And of course, time constraints are huge at a time like this. The custody time limits were in place, 6 months, but the defence were wanting custody time limits to be strictly adhered to. And the judge, I don't think the judge fully appreciated the extent of the work. So he just gave us a short while extra, which wasn't enough. So,
also, and can I ask you, because they were a dawn raid and arrested, they wouldn't necessarily know whose clothes belonged to which man.
That's right.
So the officers collected all the items, but the selection of who they belonged to must have been laborious.
Well, we didn't even attempt to do that, actually. I mean, one man was wearing some green jeans. All the rest of them were naked. So, yeah, we had no idea at that stage. I can come on to that a little bit later and how we got around that problem. But at that stage, nobody knew whose clothing was what. They didn't have their own bedrooms with clothing in it. I mean, it was just a complete tip. Literally a tip with clothing all over the floor and
So food bags,
oh, everything. Yes.
Newspapers, everything was taken.
Yeah. Well, I imagine everything was taken. Certainly, yes, I would think it. Mm. It was practice in terrorist cases to retrieve everything. When I started doing this sort of work, my boss said to me, "And you might be looking through dustbins full of rubbish." So, you know. Oh. Cass is smiling.
I worked on a CSI job and a pretty straightforward murder where the guy was actually arrested in the house at the scene, but an anti-terrorist officer who'd been exhibits officer on the anti-terrorist squad worked on it, and he wanted to take everything in the house. I said, no, it's not an anti-terrorist job. It's a murder. It's pretty straightforward, this one. We can't, you know, afford, and we haven't got the time to take everything. But it was just, that was the nature of his way, and he was used to taking everything, and they do.
So, and what was the very first thing that you led your team to check through?
Well, as I say, just removing the fibres from the tapes that were bound around the ladders from the cars and from the garage.
So what, from those tapes you could get maybe fingerprints?
Well, it went on to the fingerprint department, and that's another reason why it's so difficult in this sort of case, because the fingerprints and the fibres obviously were all on the sticky side.
Yeah.
The sticky side has to be exposed. And when we finally got the TPUs, the bombs, into the laboratory to look at, we had to remove the tape. Well, you can't just peel it off any old how. It's incredibly tenacious. It really sticks hard. And it took three of us about 2 hours to remove the tape from one bomb. Ah. There were 10 metres of tape around each bomb. So we're looking at 10 metres of tape 37 times. And it has to be, one of us has to hold the bomb down while the other two, with tweezers, forceps, peel the sticky tape off very, very slowly in short lengths, which have then to be pinned out in flat pizza-type boxes with the sticky side exposed. And when you come to examine that, to remove the fibres, again, you have to search the surface, that sticky surface, centimetre by centimetre, removing the fibres with forceps, but you have to pull them off without the use of a solvent, because if you apply a solvent, you will destroy the fingerprints. So the whole process is incredibly time-consuming. And we think we had enough work. I mean, I say we because this is not me. This is a really first-class team of people. We had enough work for about 18 months, and that's when the judge said, afraid not, you know, you can only have 3 months extra. So we started in July. In January, the judge gave us a little bit of extra time, but it was a huge amount of work. In fact, we'll come on to the results later, I'm sure, but we only had time to do this sort of work on 10 of the boxes out of the 37. And we picked off 41,000 fibres. So to give you an idea.
So, I mean, like when you say that, it makes me think that as a crime scene, it was pretty good for fibres because it's very sticky tape. A lot of things stick to it. So though it was a real pain, there was a lot of evidence there.
There was masses of evidence. But you see, it's no good looking at the outside of the tape for fibres from the clothing, because it was all found in the same house. And if you find it on the sticky side, then you know that bomb was assembled at that property. If you find it on the outside, you don't know when the bomb was assembled. You just know that it was assembled and taken to the house, picked up fibres from the house. So you can only go on the sticky side, otherwise it doesn't mean anything.
I suppose also, you know, if they sometimes people, when they're cutting tape, will use scissors or actually their mouth.
Yes, with sellotape, certainly.
Saliva.
Yeah. Not with this stuff. You couldn't bite through this stuff. You've got to cut it.
Interesting.
It's very, very, very tough.
Mm. Actually, on that, and just thinking with regard to the ends of the tape and mechanical fit to other boxes and or an original roll of tape, when you remove the tape from the box, imagine you have to be very careful about not damaging the end because of the possibility of a mechanical fit. And do the experts work alongside you when you're removing it for the mechanical fit side?
No. We never had rolls of tape. That was never recovered or certainly never sent in. If it was recovered, it wasn't sent in. We had to be careful when we cut the 10-inch length off the bomb, to make sure that the end of that cut and the beginning of the next cut could be matched together, just in case we cut through a fingerprint. So they had to be able to be matched. But mechanical fitting with ends of tapes, that didn't come into it, no.
So you couldn't open the boxes until you got the tape off.
Well, the boxes, in fact, the lids opened. The lids, in fact, I think you said they were hinged. They also had tape on them, but it was clear brown sort of parcel tape. And they had little little squares of tape on the top, each one with a time written on it, which was the time that the bomb was scheduled to be detonated. And they were scheduled to go off just a week after they were discovered in the early hours of the morning, between, I think, 2:15 and 3:15. So at 30-second intervals, there would have been 37 massive explosions in six power stations, sub-power stations over the country, over the south of the country.
Again, it goes back to, you know, you get the tip-off, and then you have to set up this massive surveillance. And, you know, you realised how much work had to go on in that time before they did the swoop. But then you have that amazing, almost quiet, as the investigation begins, you know, your side of it. It's just extraordinary the length you had to go to give the evidence of guilt. Mm.
Was there a sense of sort of, I don't know, adrenaline about a case of this size? For you, every case is the same.
Well, the scientists, I mean, their involvement is really only a small part of the whole investigation, even if the evidence that they're producing is major or significant at the trial. At the time, it's a small part of an investigation. I mean, Kaz will reassure you that the scientists, they drift in. Normally, they drift into a case, and if they go to court, they drift into the court during the trial, and they go away again.
But so you were saying that you had to go and ask for more time. Presumably, the police were consistently asking you to report back. Where had you got?
Yeah,
I mean, so there must have been pressure.
Certainly in this case, there's always a close association between the lab and the police officers in a case like this, and we certainly had to keep them informed, partly because, of course, we didn't have all the exhibits. So we had to say, look, please, can we have some more now? And when the judge finally said we had to get it all done in a short while, everything, that was fingerprints, everything submitted within the 3 months after the custody time limit ended, we had to stop working on the tapes and move on to the bombs. And so, yeah, I mean, we were under tremendous pressure, which is why we only did only 25% of the work that came in. And we produced enough evidence. We didn't actually need to do any more.
No, but if we take the evidence then, okay,
yes.
So you took these huge thousands of fibres off the tape from the ladders, tape from the bombs. You then had the clothing.
Yes.
And you can match, I presume you match the fibres to the clothing. Then comes the next step of matching the clothing to the people.
Yes. Yes, we found, in fact, when we looked at picked at the 41,000 off, we then started to look at them, because picking them off is the first bit, and then you've got to prepare them for analysis, and then you've got to look at them. And so we actually compared 9,000 fibres, and we compared those to 124 items of clothing. And we found 3,000 matches to 24 of those items. They became positive. But as you say, that only linked the clothing to the assembling of the bombs, not to the individuals. But there were two things, actually. We noticed, we knew that one of the men, when he was arrested, was wearing jeans, green jeans. And when we were picking off the fibres, we kept coming across these red cotton and polyester fibres, which were matching to a Marks and Spencer's sweatshirt. We also found an awful lot of orange cotton fibres, which were matched to an orange polo shirt. So we had two items of clothing that were cropping up a lot all the time. I mean, hundreds of them. I can give you the figures, a lot of them. And we found a lot of black fibres cropping up on the tapes. So we did say to the officers, look, there's all these black fibres, which we can't match to anything. What else have you got? And so they sent in 13 little black gloves. And these were little woolly type stretch gloves that sort of one size fits all. And quite obviously, these had been worn during the manufacture of the bombs, because they don't leave fingerprints. But when we looked at them, there were, in actual fact, four different types of fibres. They looked the same, but some were made of grey polyester, Some were made of black polypropylene. Some were made of blue-green acrylic. And another one was made of a mixture of blue-green acrylic and polyester. So there were four different fiber types. And we were founding matches to these in vast numbers on everything. So we were able to link the gloves to the bombs and then the gloves to some of the clothing. And one pair of trousers had the name of one of the defendants written on the pocket. So we assumed that that was actually the wearer of the trousers. And so we managed to link gloves in to the trousers. We linked the trousers to the orange polo shirt, which we'd already linked to the bombs. And we found a tweed jacket. And he was clearly a fellow with a sort of, you know, fashion sense, because his grey, his trousers and his orange shirt and his tweed jacket all kind of fitted nicely. And we found glove fibres from all the different pairs of gloves in the pocket of the jacket. So it was this wonderful link that we could produce with him. And with the other chap with the green jeans, we looked at the top of the jeans for red fibres that might have matched the sweatshirt, which we'd linked to the bombs, which we found. And then we found the other, going the other way, we found trousers from the, what have I said, sweatshirt onto jeans and jeans onto sweatshirt. So we did a two-way there and then gloves linking the two. So again, we linked that individual indirectly to the fibres from the tape around the bombs. So yeah, but that's all. We didn't link anybody else.
So two, clothing-wise. You got two of the defendants.
We did.
And with the others, you couldn't tell
whose clothing belonged to who. No, we didn't know.
Okay.
And whether fingerprints played a role in that, I don't know.
Yeah.
As a matter of interest, were those, I mean, in those days, DNA technically was still kind of like, I suppose, in its infancy. I don't think by then the database had been set up, or if it had, it had just been. But in today's forensic world, if those same items went in, would they aim their priority first more at if we can get DNA on the inside of the tape, and with the clothing on the, like on the necks, underwear, things like that? How do you feel they would look at fibres as a priority in this day and age now, because DNA seems to be considered the...
Well, certainly they wouldn't look at fibres, I don't think, because I don't think fibre work is done anymore. And certainly the approach is let's get DNA, because the evidence that you can get with a DNA result is amazingly powerful.
And you just said you don't think that fibre work is done so much today?
No, as far as I know, I mean, there may be some private laboratories that will do some of it. I don't think it's done to this extent at all in this country. Other countries may still be doing fibre work, but it's costly. I mean, it's incredibly expensive to do it because it takes so long.
Mm.
So if we move on to the court case and the presentation of your evidence in court, you've brought with you today, amongst your many documents, a fibre map or a plan that you'd present in court. Is that right?
Yes. In this case, I produced, with the aid of the graphics department, it's well beyond me, a sort of book of maps, so that every bomb, every time a power unit, was represented on a separate sheet of paper with all the links went to it. And that was given to the jury so that they could, as I talked through what we'd found from each time of power unit, you know, four fibres matching the settee and three matching the carpet and so on, they could follow it. They could follow that through.
It's so remarkable because, you know, looking at the American CSI, and you always see them with lasers and the bullet went through the left ear and ended up the chimney and over the road. But on this diagram that Anne has very kindly brought in, it is quite extraordinary, the dedication and the ability to show each link that came from her, from the car to jacket to basement to boots to shoes, all very, very carefully linked, which was, as you said, given to the jury
clarify. I mean, this is not airlines. This is a different case. In airlines, we produce this great sheath of pages. This particular one was an armed robbery, and the fibre evidence put like this looked like an underground map. I mean, there were so many links. So many links. And the problem with this was, how do we get this through to the jury? And I thought, well, we'll do each of the stages on an acetate sheet, which they can then overlay and build up the layers. That was my plan. The barrister that was prosecuting, who was a bit more of a techie than me, said, no, we'll get a PowerPoint going. So the day before I was due to give evidence, he came and he produced this PowerPoint with each transfer being click of the button you could show, you know. And so the following morning, I went to the Old Bailey to give start on my evidence and waited for him to come, and he didn't come. He didn't come to court. And then the company sent a message to say that he'd been mugged on the way home and he wasn't at work. So they sent somebody else along. Well, in the meantime, of course, they interposed another witness. And so I just had to sit outside and wait while they set up everything as well. And in the lunch break, we were still waiting. And then the clerk rushed out and said, there's a red light flashing on the computer. What does that mean? Well, of course, it had run out of battery. So they charged it up over lunch. We went back in and they finished the previous witness and just for half an hour or so. Then I went into the witness box and started to give my evidence. And of course, the cable from the computer in the well of the court, I mean, it's a big, these are big courts at the Old Bailey. Number two court is a massive court, and the cable wouldn't reach. So every time I wanted the next screen, of course, I had to indicate, and the CPS guy in the well of the court would click and it would come onto the screen. And the court has got a big fan light in the ceiling open to the sky. And as luck would have it, the minute we started, the clouds parted and the sun beamed through right onto the screen and you could not see a thing. So talk about a presentation going wrong. You know, it really couldn't have been. It's probably not like that now, but that is a map of what you expect a jury to follow.
Give or take PowerPoint presentations and sun on screen, how well does Fibre's evidence go down with juries generally?
Oh, I think it's great. I mean, I think it depends how you present it. But I remember a case a while ago, a big Fibre's case, which I was giving evidence for 4 days, nonstop. And the defence were quite abusive. And in the end, I had to say, look, you know, I've already told you this once, so I'll go over again. And we went over again. And it was a terrorist case. And the jury had to file out behind the witness box to get out because it couldn't go out into the public area. And as they walked past the witness box, one of them leant past me because I had to remain there until they'd gone. And he leant forward and he said, well done, Doc, as they filed out past me. So I think it does go down well, actually, if you explain it carefully and well and clearly with the aid of a diagram. I mean, most of the time, the diagrams are hugely helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And what about, I mean, in airlines, how did the defence challenge your evidence?
Funnily enough, very little, very, very little. There were about 14,000 pages of evidence that were given to the jury to go through. When I was in court, I took my main assistant with me. And I had a separate file for each bomb. So I had two crates with the notes in. And she was allowed to sit in the witness box behind me. And every time counsel moved on to the next bomb, she handed me the file for that bomb. And I got very little challenge. I think the officer said there was no more than about 15, half an hour's challenge to the whole case. It was incredibly powerful, the case.
Yeah.
I mean, they as I understand it, their defence was, it was just all a hoax. We weren't going to have Simtex, we were going to use sugar. And it was just for fun. Well, the jury weren't going to buy that, were they? So.
No, and I believe, just reading up on it, that this was like a really seminal moment in the history of prosecuting IRA cases because one of them decided to give evidence, which they'd never done before.
Yes, it was. It was the man in the green...
The man
in the green trousers. And that's the first time an IRA active service agent had ever given evidence on the mainland. In fact, he was acquitted.
Was he?
He was the one. Two were acquitted. The one that was found in Birmingham, who was the kind of guy who did all the organising and financing, he was acquitted. I think they were rearrested afterwards, but they were acquitted of the charge this time. And the green trouser man was acquitted.
So one of the people you actually had evidence against was acquitted. Mm. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I don't know what the following charges were, but when he left the court, apparently he was rearrested and re-interviewed.
I was just wondering, Anne, with the way that things are today, and you said earlier about Fibre's and you don't know of anybody who's actually sort of doing other than independent companies. We now have a lot of in-house police labs. It makes me wonder, though, do they actually even consider how good Fibre evidence could be? And in your opinion, do you think that is something that's important that might now be missed?
Yes, I'm sure that's the case. I'm sure that there are times when there are evidence types that are not done anymore, but could be invaluable. And I think with high collision road traffic accidents is one case in point, partly because it's not done and partly because a lot of people don't even know about it. And that isn't just transfer of fibres. That's a thing that happens when there's a high energy collision, happens with fibres. I remember a case a while back where there was a couple of lads went to a pub. They went separately, each in their own cars, but they left in a single car. They'd been drinking all night. Nobody saw them get into the car, so nobody saw who was driving. The car went off at high speed and overtook a bus that saw the car disappear around a corner. And when the bus got around the corner, the car had crashed into some railings. It had hit the curb, it had spun around, it had crashed into the railings, and the passengers from the car had been ejected across the back of the car and through the rear window, which was open. And they were found in a street nearby. One man had spinal injuries. He couldn't move, so it was believed the other man had pulled him out, actually, through the back window, probably. But they needed to know who was driving at the time. Now, they were both in the car, so DNA wouldn't have helped them. But when there is a high impact between a fabric and a surface, phenomenal temperatures are in a split second reached. And there's this sort of energy of friction, and the plastic melts just briefly. Fibers that are impacted into it get stuck into it, and it rapidly cools and the fibers remain. These are called fiber plastic fusions. And it's a snapshot in time, so it can tell you exactly who was in contact with that plastic surface at that moment. And you can also get plastic coatings on the items themselves. And in this particular case, we were able to show that one of the men who was wearing beige jeans, he was the one who was driving, because the fibres were impacted into the steering wheel, which had been bent at an angle, and the fibres were deeply embedded into the plastic of the steering wheel. And the other gentleman who was wearing a red top, his fibres were impacted deeply into the pile of the fabric of the passenger seat, and not in a way that would have happened if you just sat there. So in those sorts of cases, that's the only way you would have known who was driving. It was important because the man with the broken spine died. The guy that turned out to be driving, the car was stolen. It wasn't insured. The guy that he'd bought it from had been murdered. I mean, you wouldn't make it up, you know. And so it was quite important to find out who was actually driving at the time. So those sorts of, but that's rare. But I mean, it happens, and to the family and to everybody, it was important to get a result.
Hmm. Has fibre analysis evolved a great deal since 1996?
No. I'm afraid it hasn't. A lot is done to a fibre, apart from us picking it off and then mounting it up for microscopic examination. I mean, once you've compared it under a microscope to see if it does match, I mean, I'm not talking about bomb chem, just in any case now. You compare it under a microscope at a low power, then you compare it under a high power, 400 times magnification. You look at it with three different light sources. You can then extract the dye from it and see what colour components of the dye are. You can do work on it to show whether it's a nylon or an acrylic or a polyester or whatever. So a lot goes into analysing a fibre, and that hasn't changed. There have been moves to try and speed up the process with automatic searching and so on, but it's never taken off, and it's not as good actually as sitting down and doing it by hand.
Yeah. Well, what a shame if we don't see so much fibres work, because that has been fascinating and an extraordinary example of sort of meticulous forensic examination and dedication and hard work. My God, what a lot of hours for you and your team.
Absolutely.
But thank you so much for coming back and sharing it with us. Thank you, Linda, Kaz. Another brilliant episode, and we look forward to talking to everyone again next week for the last episode in the series, Forensic Searches and the Murder of April Jones. Until then, subscribe to the series wherever you're listening now, and if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a nice rating too. And if you want to know more about the podcast and Linda's books, check out her website at lindalaplante.com. Her new novel, Vanished, is out on the 31st of March in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. Until next week, thanks for listening.